This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi everybody, Anita here, welcoming you to today's Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning. We have made it to Friday and breathe. Hands up anyone who's suffering with a bit of anxiety at the moment. I'm not going to lie, both of mine are currently well in the air. Well, we're going to learn how to breathe properly later and maybe alleviate some of that stress in the process. It's my Friday gift to you all. I also want you to get any microaggressions you may have experienced off your chest today. Subtle digs, insults, offence, whether intentional or unintentional, you may have had to deal with, as we're talking about microaggressions around black hair in just a moment. So my most recent experience was with someone I just met in a work environment. I was about to interview them and the first thing they asked me was, have I always lived in this country? So, of course, I said, no, I grew up in Yorkshire. So what's your experience of any microaggressions, whether it's to do with your race, gender, sexuality, or indeed your hair? You can text Woman's Hour 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Check with your network provider for extra costs, or you can get in touch via social media at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. Now, we're also unearthing a bit of hidden history today, a hero who you will most probably never have heard of, the first suffragette to die for the cause and the sister of Emmeline Pankhurst, no less. Now a group want to immortalise her in statue form, but not before they've told us why. And if any of you have seen Mindhunter on Netflix, about how the FBI, along with psychologist Wendy Carr, get inside the minds of serial killers, apparently it's excellent viewing. I'll be talking to the real-life inspiration behind her character, Anne Burgess. Her story is fascinating. She's now in her 80s and she's still an absolute force, so not to be missed. And we'll also be having the final episode of Lamentation a little bit later, but first. 93% of black people in the UK have experienced hair discrimination, according to a recent survey. Hair touching without consent is the most commonly experienced microaggression reported by nearly half of the black people surveyed, and a quarter say they've been picked on at school or work because of their hair. So why in 2021 is this still an issue? Well, Katie Ann Rocha is from the Halo Collective, an organisation of people working to put a stop to hair discrimination, and Emma DeBerry is the author of the book Don't Touch My Hair. Welcome to Woman's Hour, both of you. Katie Ann, you've got quite a job on your hand, haven't you, if you want to put an end to this when 93% of people say they've experienced hair discrimination. So explain what people are telling you is happening. What is hair discrimination?
So hair discrimination can take place in the form of exclusions from school, little comments and insults that people make about hair. Common ones are that Afro-textured hair is wild, messy, unkempt, needs to be tamed. We've had a lot of stories of people telling us that they are so quick to adapt their hair and try to change their hair to when they're going to school, just to stop comments being made to them. So me personally, my experience with hair discrimination has been through people telling me that I need to comb my hair, telling me that I need to change my hair in order for it to be neater. So yeah, these are all the little things that can build up to the wider issue that is hair discrimination.
Emma, you wrote a book about this 2 years ago. 2 years on, 93% of people still say they've experienced hair discrimination. I mean, why is it so damaging?
Wow, yeah. So first of all, hi, Kayleanne. Big up to you and all the work you're doing. It's so impressive. So thank you.
I like that. Well, that's a very nice way to kind of bring yourself into this. Yes, absolutely. How old are you, Katie Anne?
I'm 16.
16, yes. Wow. So amazing.
Wow. So yes, the book was written 2 years ago. At this stage, we still have 93% of people saying, of Black people saying this is something that they've experienced. And to be honest, I consider that, counterintuitive as that may sound, I consider it progress in that at least now, you know, that those figures are there and the conversation is having this type of mainstream attention, you know, and all of these initiatives like the Halo Collective are happening, because that discrimination has been there, you know, historically, but it just hasn't been so openly acknowledged and named in the way that it is now, so that we can like go about addressing it.
So how is it being played out, let's say, in the workforce? On a day-to-day, let's like really explain to everyone listening how this manifests itself. What is going on?
So first of all, you know, I think when one talks about hair, there's this assumption that it's just like a superficial or like a frivolous topic. And it's really just something, you know, that women or girls are talking about, and it's to do with vanity. And it's so much, it's so much deeper than that. There is certain norms that one is expected to conform to be deemed as being suitable in the workplace or in the school environment. Most of those norms are quite easy to achieve if your features are a certain way. When we think about hair, those norms have developed to suit the characteristics of European textured hair or non-Afro textured hair. Our hair texture is dramatically different to other hair textures, and it requires completely different techniques and methods, you know, to maintain it. For our hair to resemble how what is deemed as professional, which is like very, very culturally specific, you know, it's not professional. Professionalism isn't kind of neutral in how we perceive it, or to conform to the school uniform policy, we have to do, you know, intensive labor to achieve those looks, and also go through processes that are often very damaging to our hair, because the norm is, you know, to have your hair kind of straight or going down, or even hair that you can tie back easily, you know. In order to do that, we really have to straighten our hair, either by like a chemical process or by heat processes, which are really damaging. My hair is covered today. This is another thing. When I was in school, because my hair isn't done, okay, I didn't have time to do it, so I'm wearing a head wrap. This should be a completely ordinary thing to be able to wear into school or work. I wouldn't have been allowed wear a head wrap to school. But for me to kind of, you know, maintain a neat appearance when my hair isn't done, which takes hours, a head wrap is, as you can see, a very neat, quote unquote, looking item. So I think that acknowledgement needs to be there, that we have different norms, you know, for our hair.
And so this is to both of you. How are these microaggressions playing out sort of day in, day out? I mean, tell me about your own personal experiences, Emma. What happens to you in the workplace? What do people say? Just how do these small comments affect you?
I think you have to spend a lot of time and energy into thinking about how you're going to present yourself for a particular event or place that you're going to be. And you have to think, well, if I go with my hair just as it grows from my head, if I go with my hair in an afro, which is how my hair is, you know, when I don't have braids or when I haven't twisted it or done one of these styles, what assumptions are going to be made about me, and how is this going to impact that experience? Are people going to think things that I've been accused of, are people going to think that I have an afro, so I'm some sort of quote unquote militant, or I've been asked, am I anti-white because I'm wearing my hair as it grows from my head, you know, because these are the assumptions with Afro textured hair, or class assumptions, or just different judgments that will be made about you that might be damaging if it's, you know, a job interview, or if it's something that your behavior or your appearance is very important.
And Katie-Anne, how is it playing out in schools? How does it affect children in schools?
So in schools, I think I can identify two different ways in which hair discrimination plays out. So one is where it's quite extreme, where students are actively taken out of class or even sent to the back of their classes because their hair is too big and too distracting. Or it comes through the comments of, oh, can I touch your hair? Your hair's so big. Oh, you look like a lion, or it looks like a bird's nest. These can seem to outsiders as really small comments that don't mean much, but once it builds up over time, it can really take a knock to the confidence of kids. And in school years, these are your formative years. These are where you start to express yourself, start to build up your first sense of identity. And when people are making comments about something that's so culturally significant to you, and it's such a key part of your identity, it can really take a big knock to them and their pride.
Yeah, I mean, you hit on something there. In the survey, it said that hair touching without consent is the most commonly experienced microaggression. And you said that, you know, some people might not think this is a big deal. So explain why it is a big deal. Because some people might say, you know, maybe I just wanted to pay you a compliment. Maybe I'm just curious.
I mean, compliments and showing appreciation for people can always take place in other forms. You could call their hair beautiful. I'm sure a lot of people would appreciate that. But once it comes to a lot of people touching hair without consent, especially, it can make people feel like they're in some sort of petting zoo, and it's like they're the other in that situation. And all of a sudden, they've been made to stick out. They've been made to feel different to everyone else.
And I think it's often in environments where you already feel conspicuous because you might be the only Black person, you might be the only person of color, and then that attention on your hair is just kind of adding to a situation in which you already might feel self-conscious. And I've had a number of times people reach out and touch it without consent and then say things like, oh my God, it feels like pubes. You know, as a teenage girl, I mean, it's happened to me as a teenager and as an adult, that's not something that is particularly enjoyable, particularly specifically when you're in an environment, again, where you are only the only person of African descent or the only Black person.
Yeah, because on one hand, it's not an overtly oppressive act like a racist slur, but it is equally upsetting.
And I think it goes back to, it's people want to comment about your race, but there are certain things they can't say, but they're like, oh, but I can ask about the hair. But sometimes it is the kind of the equivalent of, where are you from? Or why are, like, they want to ask you about your Blackness, and they feel the hair is the entry point into that.
And as Katie-Anne said, it's such a fundamental to your identity. And it's so bound up, your hair heritage is bound up in your history. And the story of it.
Absolutely. So one of the things that was really important for me in writing Don't Touch My Hair was, while there is all of this discrimination and there is a lot of stigma attached to Afro-textured hair that finds its roots in the transatlantic slave trade and the processes of dehumanization that occurred in that period to kind of to dehumanize Black people, essentially to justify the enslavement, I really wanted to tell the other side of the story as well, which is that our hair is this, Afro-textured hair is this wonderful material that lends itself to being manipulated into all types of incredible structural shapes. So we have this history of braiding, for instance, and I go into the science of that, different social histories around braiding, the different meanings. Braiding patterns are replete with meaning and forms of technology. So Don't Touch My Hair has a chapter on maths, mapping and coding and how that pertains to the patterns in our hair. So I really wanted the story of our hair not to just be steeped in this story of discrimination and history of oppression.
Yeah, well, I think we've barely scratched the surface with this, but I want to thank you both. Katianne, you're only 16. You've set up the Halo Collective. There's a lot of work to be done. If you want to get involved with the discussion, you can. Please do share your experiences by texting 84844. Emma and Katianne, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. Now, you probably know the names of Emmeline Pankhurst and Emily Wilding Davison, but what about Mary Clark? Well, she was Emmeline's sister and the first woman to die for the suffrage movement, and yet she's been almost entirely forgotten over the course of the last century. Well, now a new campaign is pushing for a statue of her to be erected in Brighton, where currently there are only two statues of women, both of Queen Victoria. Jean Calder is a founder of both the Brighton and Hove Women's History Group and the Mary Clark Statue Appeal, and she joins me now. Very good morning to you, Jean. So who was Mary Clark?
Good morning. Well, as you say, she was Emmeline's sister. She was, from the point of view of Brighton, she, in 1909 to 1910, which is the last 2 years of her life, she worked as paid organiser for the Women's Social and Political Union, the suffragette organisation in Brighton, incredibly hardworking, very, very effective organiser, and died at the end of that time in really tragic circumstances. I mean, she'd grown up with Emily and she'd been very close to her. She was autistic, and they ran a small business together very ineffectively. But she'd supported Emily all along the way, but one of the most interesting things about her was that where Emmeline made a very good marriage to Richard Pankhurst, Mary married a man called John Clark, who was abusive, and after several years of marriage she managed to extricate herself, but during that time she experienced destitution, she had to flee several times. And she obviously had enormous courage, a very, very difficult thing to do at that time. And it was after that that she really became very involved in the suffrage movement.
And where did she fit in with it? How did she fit in with Emmeline and Emily and all and the suffragettes that we know about?
Well, she was involved right from the start, from 1903. 1906, her name appears as one of the central committee that set up the National Women's Social and Political Union. So she was a key part of it. She went to prison three times. But she, unlike Emmeline, she was a bit lacking in self-confidence, possibly because of the experience she had in her marriage. She was initially very supportive to Emmeline, so she would look after the children. She would do Emmeline's job, her paid job, so that Emmeline could go out and campaign. But then she became an organiser. And I think that's when she was coming into her. And the tragedy of it is that her life was cut short. But all the accounts of her life in that those last couple of years of her life was that she was incredibly effective, that she was brave, but also what comes across is her gentleness. She was, you know, she wasn't a charismatic speaker, though she did do public speaking. But she was very, very active, hardworking. She used to sell the newspaper in Brighton. She was out in all weathers, having open-air meetings. She suffered many assaults by hostile crowds. And what comes across again and again from all the people who observed her was that she could turn aside aggression by reason and good humour. She could be very funny. And that comes across in the accounts in local newspapers after her death. But it is really that combination of gentleness and dignity, as well as a certain frailness, with this huge courage and bravery, which showed at the end of her life particularly. And there were several instances of her going in to assist women who are under attack and so on. She was very, very committed to non-violence, but she would always go to support other women. But at the end of her life, she was present at what was known as Black Friday, which is on the 18th of November, 1910, where 300 women were savagely beaten by the police and plainclothes and uniformed. It was believed on Home Office instruction. They were sexually assaulted as well. Their breasts were attacked. It was very, very consistent. And then several women were very badly injured there. And she obviously was injured as well. I mean, we don't know the extent of that, but we do know that she was bedridden for 3 days afterwards. And then she went back to London to protest And on that occasion, about the police treatment, on that occasion, she deliberately broke a window of a police station, got a month's imprisonment as a result of that. That we think that was her first actually illegal action, mm-hmm. Although it was the third time she'd been imprisoned. And then she went on hunger strike. Although she was very frail and ill, went on hunger strike, was forcibly fed, was released on the 23rd of December 1910. And on the 25th, she died of a brain hemorrhage. So the assumption has to be that there was some sort of head injury. Mm. Probably her sister, who was absolutely devastated by this, thought it was Black Friday. And she was, so they all referred to her as the first martyr.
And how old was she when she died?
She was just 59.
She was so young. I mean, what an incredible story. You know, she was right there involved, you know, like say the first martyr, but also did a hugely important job of looking after Emmeline's children as well, to supporting her sister throughout all of this. Why is so little known about her?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, we were, back in 2018, we were looking to get to find out about the local suffrage movement in Brighton and to get blue plaques, but also the possibility of a statue. And I found a reference to Mary in the back of a book. I mean, I will never forget it, actually. There's just a line saying that two women died on Black Friday, one of whom was Mary Clark, who was Emily Plank's sister and who worked in Brighton. And my jaw nearly hit the table, you know, and I thought, this is it, but why? One can only speculate, and apart from the obvious, which is that she was a woman. If she'd been a man, you know, I mean, we celebrate the first soldier to die in the World Wars, the last soldier to die. We know the names, we know where they're buried. We don't celebrate. I mean, we have the Tolpadil martyrs who weren't actually martyred. They didn't die. So here we have Mary.
And so why do you think she's the right person for a new statue? Why do you think that's the right way to celebrate her?
I think it's hugely significant to ordinary people. I think there's been an enormous amount of support from children, from adults. I think women particularly feel that there are lots of statues of men. It's a terrible realisation over the last few years that there are hardly any memorials, blue plaques or statues of women. And that children need images of female heroism, but also she was somebody who will matter to other people as well, because what she was fighting for in terms of justice and democracy and freedom is going to be significant to a number of people. And she'd experienced torture, she experienced state aggression, and she'd experienced domestic violence. So there are a number of people, I think her story resonates. Well,
yes, absolutely. Jean, thank you very much and good luck with the campaign to get that statue down in Brighton. Lots of you getting in touch with microaggressions, talking about black hair in particular this morning. Elaine has texted to say no one should be able to walk up to anyone and touch their hair. An assumption has been made that this is acceptable. No, it is not. 84844 is the number to text, or you can also tweet or get in touch via social media at BBC Woman's Hour. Now, you may have seen the series Mindhunter on Netflix, which tells the story of FBI agents Holden Ford and Bill Tench and psychologist Dr. Wendy Carr as they team up to attempt to get inside the minds of serial killers back in the 70s and 80s. The characters were inspired by the work of a real unit, and Wendy is based on Anne Wolbert Burgess, a forensic nurse and academic in Boston. Anne did some pioneering work with rape trauma victims, which led her to work with the FBI. She's now in her 80s and she's still teaching, and there are waiting lists for her courses in forensics and victimology. When I spoke to Anne, I asked her about that initial rape research, how it came about back in the 70s.
Well, that came about because I was an academic at the time. I was at Boston College. One of my colleagues there, Linda Lytle Holmstrom, who was a sociologist, had an idea for a new project, and she wanted to study rape. She knew this was going to be a problem. She was following the consciousness raising groups of that time. And so she invited me to join her. So that's really how the genesis, if you will, of the project started.
And you say she knew this was going to be a problem. Why did she know this?
Well, back in the mid to late 60s and into the early 70s, the women were gathering together in small groups and talking about things that they had never talked about before. And this was bringing together all kinds of women, whether they were working women or homewives or whatever. And one of the topics that they kept bringing up was this problem of sexual assault and sexual violence. So she had gone to, Linda had gone to some of these meetings. They were in the big cities and the momentum was going. Pressure was also being put on to the legislatures to do something about investigating rape cases.
And what were you finding? What were the attitudes? I think we forget, don't we? It's very quick to forget what the attitudes were around rape at the time in the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, there were seven major ones. The two I was most familiar with is they would say, well, what's the woman doing out at a certain hour of time? So when she was breaking, quote, the social rules of, say, being alone outside at 7 o'clock at night or something like that, that was considered. The other was what she wore. Maybe she was wearing a skimpy dress or something. And the third one was maybe that's what she secretly wanted, that she really wanted to get raped. There are these wild kinds of myths out there.
I mean, and I know this was the 60s and we have obviously progressed, but really, how far do you think we've come?
Oh, I wish we could say had come further, but we still have these. I've just seen a case where the defense lawyer held up a picture of the victim as a high school graduate holding a bottle of beer and saying, and you expect us to believe that this wasn't consent. So the whole issue of consent is still alive and well, and juries will buy it. So it's been a constant battle of women trying to get some kind of leverage as we move along. It's been very, very difficult.
You've been described as a living legend by the American Academy of Nurses. I mean, what a title, what an honour. And it was nurses who you recruited to work on this study, wasn't it?
Yes. Nursing is my basic profession.
Could you give us a definition of rape trauma then? Because you worked on this, you developed it. What is a definition?
Well, the trauma was that we realized that it created a lot of problems afterwards, that a person couldn't just go on with her life as if nothing had happened, that it created a crisis. So trauma was the word that we used in physical injury, and we just extended it to psychological injury. There were four basic areas that women had difficulty with. Of course, the physical, sometimes there was bruising and bleeding and things like that. So she had physical injury. She also had social injury or trauma where she couldn't tell people. It was they felt shame. Sexual was a big issue. Having to get into a sexual relationship again was a difficult one. And then, of course, all of the psychological issues had to do with the flashbacks, the fears, the phobias. Basically found that it was the fear of being killed that set into motion the psychological. So that if she was raped inside, she became terrified to stay alone inside. Say she had been raped outside, became the fear of going out alone or things like that. So we saw the actual psychological genesis, if you will, of the trauma.
And then this led on to you setting up the rape counseling program in Boston. Tell me about that.
Linda and I had started a counseling program. All of the victims that we saw, we followed up. We had 146 in the first year. And the nurses at the hospital wanted to continue our work. And so we trained them. And that was really how the counseling program at Boston City Hospital started.
And then, and there's another twist in your tale. Because your research led to you working with the FBI on their investigations. So tell me how that came about.
Well, that came about from a publication. It was Roy Hazelwood was at the FBI Academy. He taught sex crimes and was out in Los Angeles and mentioned that he had this new assignment. He's going to have to talk on rape investigation, and he didn't know anything about it, and did anyone know? Of course, nobody raised their hand. This was to a group of agents and law enforcement. But afterwards, Rita Connett came up to him. She was a police officer in the detective division, and she said she also was a nurse. saw my article in American Journal of Nursing and said to Roy, why don't you give her a call? She's on the East Coast. And he did.
How fortuitous. It just goes to show. And thank goodness they had a female police officer. Otherwise, that would never have happened.
Never would have happened. Never. And so, so it shows you the power of publication is important. So he invited me down. And at first, I was a little bit hesitant because I'd only been speaking to women's groups and rape crisis and nurses. And I thought, gee, do I want to speak to a group of men on this? And then I decided, yes, I did. I wanted, and I said to him, I want to see how they think about rape. And I did. I went down and that started the relationship with the Academy.
Well, it sounds like it was an incredible relationship because not only did you talk to them about the research you've been doing into rape, you actually encouraged them to formulate the first profiles of serial killers as well.
Well, also what they were doing at that time is they were getting all these calls from police departments that said, we had this terrible murder. We don't know, can't understand it. Can you help us? And they were informally profiling the type of person that they felt had committed this murder. So also at that time, they were getting pressure to do their own research. So they said, would you help us? So I really became the method, what we call the methodologist. I helped them develop this, the questionnaire of 57 pages, 488 variables. I mean, it's huge. And so their job was to go into the prisons, interview these serial killers, bring back the tapes. My little group, we'd listen to the tapes and put it onto these master surveys and get all the data in and then crunch it down. And that's what our serial killer profiling was. So we also studied two things we did. We looked at the characteristics of serial killers, 36. And then we also looked at how they profiled the cases, how they would go to a crime scene and say, this is the type of person, not who. You know, we wouldn't say, well, this was John Smith or whatever, but this was a male. He would, might have his race, his education, his work habits. Those were the kinds of things that they profiled.
And this is what led to the Netflix series Mindhunter, where you're fictionalized as the psychologist, Dr. Wendy Carr. How closely did they stick to the facts in the series?
They stuck to the facts on the cases. They were very good on the cases, but they where they went off base is the backgrounds of the three of us, Douglas, Ressler, and myself. They tried to put, I don't know, they just made up very unusual backgrounds. Instead of taking the actual backgrounds, I think would have been much better. But that's Hollywood for you. You know, they
Well, it is an absolutely excellent series. So you must be very pleased with that. And that, you know, your work is being shown and it has made such a huge impact. But, you know, you did say, look, we haven't come as far as you hoped. We know that. We know that there's still judgments made on rape victims. Yes. There aren't enough people who are convicted of rape.
It's still a lot of shame and guilt. And in the college group, which is the largest group of ages for women to be raped, is the whole issue of drinking on campus. And we've tried to work harder on that because college students won't come forward against another college student.
Talking to Anne Burgess there, an absolute force. Now, when people are stressed or anxious, which, let's face it, is most of us at the moment, we're often told to take some deep breaths to help us relax. It's nothing new, of course. There are writings from China and India that are over 2,000 years old extolling the virtues of controlled breathing for mental, physical and spiritual health. Now there's a real resurgence in these ideas at the moment, mostly going by the name of breath work. But is there anything in it? To talk us through it all is Rebecca Dennis. She's a breathing coach and author of a new audiobook called Breathe. And we've also got Mike Thomas, a professor of primary care research and expert in the use of breathing exercises for asthma at the University of Southampton. Welcome to you both. Rebecca, every single person, I can guarantee, listening to Woman's Hour right now is breathing. Surely it's the most natural thing on earth. Why do we need to be taught how to breathe?
Yes, you're right. Obviously, we're all breathing. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And we inhale, we exhale 26,000 times a day. So we can't be conscious of every single breath that we're taking. But when we work with breathwork and when we know, it's so important to understand that the way that we breathe is indicative to how we feel about life, and we can change the way that we feel and think just by changing the rhythms and the patterns and the depths of our breathing.
So what are we doing wrong? What is breath work?
Well, breath work is, there's thousands and thousands of techniques out there. And breath work is really working with the breath in the way that obviously it's automatic. We don't have to think about breathing. We breathe in and we inhale and we exhale every day. But when we work with it consciously, we can change our states. So on some more advanced levels of breath work, we can work with it at a more therapeutic level when we're working with PTSD or we're working with trauma, or otherwise we can just work at other levels when we're trying to change our state. From if we're feeling anxious, we can use the breath to help us to feel more calm. And if we're feeling scattered, again, we can connect to our breath, we can change the patterns of our breath, and it can help us to feel more focused. And even if we're feeling a bit tired, like at 4 o'clock, rather than reaching for an espresso, you can use other techniques which can help to make you feel more energized as well. So it really is this multifaceted tool, a bit like a Swiss Army knife, really, that we've got. It's right underneath our nose. It's free. And I never say it's a one size fits all breath techniques. You know, it's really about how the way that I love to teach breath work is become the architect of your own breathing practice and just understand more about why we're breathing in the way that we are.
So, Mike, you've been working in this area as a research scientist for nearly 30 years. Can changing the way we breathe really improve our health? Are you with Rebecca on this?
Yeah, I think I broadly am. Anita, I think, you know, breathing is something we all do all the time. And like you say, we think, do we need to think about breathing? Isn't it just automatic? But there are different patterns of breathing. And it's clear that there's, you know, although there's a, you know, we all breathe, we can, if we want to, we can hold our breath. You know, if we get anxious, we maybe start to overbreathe. So there are different breathing patterns that slip into our daily life.
Why does that happen? Sorry.
And it is clear that emotions and breathing are very closely linked together, so that, you know, if you're under stress, your breathing pattern can change. And some people can kind of slip into abnormal, what we call dysfunctional breathing patterns quite easily. And it seems particularly people with underlying lung disease, you know, who get episodes of breathlessness, which make them very anxious and maybe trigger breathing patterns that make the symptoms worse rather than better. And also people with anxiety can perhaps do this.
So, and what is that happening there, Mike? Why does anxiety make us breathe in a different way? What's going on?
Well, normal quiet breathing is predominantly through the abdomen. It's what we call diaphragmatic breathing. But when we're excited or when we're kind of stimulated and the adrenaline's flowing, we get ready for much greater activity, and we also start to breathe with our upper chest. So, what can happen is that people who should be breathing quite kind of quietly through the and regularly through their abdomen can actually start to do irregular upper chest breathing, also mouth breathing, because normal quiet breathing is nasal breathing. And these things, you know, they're actually quite useful to breathe in that way if you have to run harder, if you have to fight, or if you're under stress. But if you're actually having to cope with daily life, you know, these can actually produce abnormal symptoms which can actually make things worse.
And what's the difference between breathing through our nose and breathing through our mouth?
Well, the function of the nose is to filter the air, you know, remove particles to warm the air and to humidify the air. So it's like an air conditioner, really. And so if we're breathing straight into our mouth, we're breathing kind of unhumidified, cold and dirty air straight into the lungs, and that can be an irritant to the lungs, and it can cause sensations that are unpleasant. And if you've got something like asthma, it can actually make the asthma worse.
I've seen things online that say it stimulates our parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest part. Can you explain what that is, and is it true?
Yeah, I think broadly it is true. I mean, it's like many things, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but there is a close link between breathing and the nervous system and the emotional centres. And the sympathetic nervous system is kind of there for fight and flight, and the parasympathetic nervous system is more the kind of background, you know, enabling us to cope in an efficient and functional way. And if we're overstimulated and the sympathetic nervous system's in hyperdrive, this can actually lead to, you know, these dysfunctional situations and abnormal breathing patterns that can make people feel unwell in various ways and can be corrected by the kind of exercises that Rebecca's talking about.
Well, Rebecca, we should there'll be lots of people keen to know what we should be doing, how we should be breathing properly, and certainly how we can alleviate a bit of stress and anxiety at the moment. So could you talk us through something really basic very quickly, how we should all be breathing? Maybe we could all do it whilst you're listening. Let's do some breathing.
Got to do this.
Yes. Just
so that I don't go on for too long. How long have we got? A couple of minutes?
Yes, about a minute or so. A couple of
okay.
minutes.
As Mike was saying, when we're using a deep diaphragmatic breath, then that's really the breath that we want to be using throughout the day. And when we're in this state of fight or flight, then we tend to be breathing much more up in the upper chest and overusing muscles that we don't need to be using. So those muscles start to get overused and contracted, and then that becomes a more unhealthy breathing pattern. So just by, first of all, just feeling your feet on the ground and just having breath awareness, so just being aware of how you're breathing and the way that you're breathing and just noticing the breath in your body.
Yep, doing it.
And as you're inhaling and exhaling, just seeing if you can push your belly away as you inhale.
I've spent a lot of time holding my belly in, so you're telling me to just push it out.
Absolutely. And this is where, because so many people condition to hold their belly in, they're not using these lower abdominal muscles, the diaphragm and these other muscles, which really are the primary breathing muscles. And this is how we get unhealthy breathing habits. So if we just put our hands on our belly and just every day, just noticing, you know, when you're emailing, when you're texting, am I breathing? How am I breathing? Am I holding my breath? Is my breath shallow? And just breathing into your belly, breathing into your hand. So as you're breathing in,
yeah,
you put your belly away. And then as you exhale, your belly comes in. And because if that's not been something that you've been doing for a very long time, that can feel like it's really hard. So really, the more that we train and the more that we practice that every day, then we can just get the body to remember how we used to breathe when we were babies and when we were toddlers.
And that's why you see little babies' bellies pushing out when they're breathing. And so that's what we should be doing. Release our bellies. We're not going anywhere at the moment anyway. So we've all got stretch pants on, so this should be very easy. So just breathing into our diaphragm, release our bellies, just relax and enjoy it. And
absolutely.
It's simple as that. Rebecca, thank you so much. Mike, obviously, very quickly, there'll be people out there saying, you know, lots of people making claims, making money out of this. We should just, any advice how to navigate it?
Yeah, I think this is a very useful technique, and particularly people with asthma might want to consider it. But some of the claims that have been made in the past have been inflated, and it's not a cure. This is something people do as well as, not instead of, their standard treatment.
Good advice. Thank you both very much for joining me this morning. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
A new podcast series from BBC Radio 4.
In the first stage of a poltergeist haunting, the entity will confine itself to making noise, as if it's testing its victims.
The Battersea Poltergeist.
My name's Shirley Hitchens. I'm 15 years old. I live with my mum, dad, brother, gran, and Donald.
Subscribe to The Battersea Poltergeist on BBC Sounds.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.